and welcome to the Houston Innovators Podcast. I'm Natalie Harms, editor of Innovation Map. My guest for today is Sassy Duggleby, co-founder and CEO of Venus Aerospace, an early-stage hard tech company that's developing hypersonic space planes that can enable high-speed international travel. Sassy, who was recently named to Inc. magazine's Top 200 Female Founders list, shares how she co-founded the company with her husband, Andrew, after an idea they had in 2018. They moved the company from the West Coast to Houston in 2021, and now they are developing this revolutionary way to travel right from the Houston spaceport. Sassy, thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Well, I've had the pleasure of hearing you speak at a few events over the years, and I just am always impressed with your presence, and you seem like such a natural born leader. So it makes me wonder, you know, were you always this leader focused, even as a kid throughout your whole career? Did you always want to be an entrepreneur?
You know, I don't know that I would say I grew up thinking I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I come from my dad worked the same job for 25 years, you know, very steady family. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. But I did tend to find myself in leadership positions. I was really involved with a summer camp. I went to a girls' camp in Kerrville, and ended up being kind of the head of the, they had two different groups. And so I ended up being kind of the chief of the tribe is what they called it. And so pretty early on, I tended to find myself in leadership roles. I thankfully was, you know, school came easy for me. And so I did really well in school. And then when I went to college, I went to Texas A&M and ended up being president of my sorority. So I have over my career found myself in leadership. I don't know that it's something I naturally sought out, if that makes sense. And I did not even think about entrepreneurship until I ended up getting my MBA for grad school. And I took an entrepreneurship course there. And that was the first time I ever even realized that there's people out there called venture capitalists that would give you money for an idea and you could go grow a company. And so that was really the first time I was probably 26 when I was getting my MBA. And that was the first time I really kind of got inspired that, hey, there's a way to go build companies from nothing and grow them into, you know, large organizations that are giving back to the world. But did I ever dream at that time that it would be a, you know, a space plane company and this is what our future entailed? Absolutely not.
That's amazing. Well, you got bit by the entrepreneurship bug and the startup world, and then you went on to have a pretty extensive career in tech and startup. So tell me a little bit about like the transition from being a part of that world to, you know, having that idea for Venus Aerospace. Was it a light bulb moment for you, or did it kind of come over some time?
Yeah. So, you know, it's actually a pretty long story as to how we actually got here. So, you know, Andrew is my husband and he and I founded Venus together. So I always say he's the PhD rocket scientist. I'm the MBA engineer. So I started my career as an engineer. So we had a company in College Station when Andrew was a professor, and we grew, he had a small business that he and a friend started. And I ended up joining that company after working at a biotech spin out from A&M. So that's where we actually learned we work really, really well together. And we had the opportunity to kind of exit that company and move to Southern California to work for Virgin Orbit, which was Richard Branson's small satellite launching company where we were launching rockets from the wing of an airplane. And so, you know, got out to Southern California, kind of learned the rocket industry. And then in 2018, it was actually a really bad year for the Navy. And Andrew is a Navy reservist. And in the Navy, he actually does ship repair. So he's a PhD rocket scientist doing ship repair. That doesn't always line up, but anyways. So we got called out to deploy to Japan. And it was actually living in Japan that we had this idea that, you know, Andrew and I were sitting looking over the balcony of the U.S. Ships looking out over Tokyo Bay. And we were actually talking about how do we get home for my grandmother's birthday that was coming up. And it was really the first time while we had traveled overseas a bunch, we had never actually lived overseas. But when you live overseas, you intimately understand how big the world is. You know, it was 13 hours to get from Tokyo back to Dallas, and then you know, what do we do with the kids? Do we take the kids? Jet lag with kids is horrible. And so we were just chatting through it. And he said, you know, there's this new type of rocket engine that has been coming down the pipelines of academia for a long time. And he said, and he was always phrasing it as like, how could this engine send more payloads to space? And it was living in Japan that he said, you know, this engine, I think we could put it on a plane and we could be home in an hour. And so that was kind of the light bulb moment for Venus, but I laughed at him. I was like, yeah, right, that you could put an engine on a vehicle and we'd be home in an hour from Japan. But he started kind of explaining it to me how this engine's way more efficient. You don't have to have as much fuel. You could have wings and landing gear. And so we started dreaming on it. And that's actually, we came up with the name Venus Aerospace, actually living in Japan. And I bought the name on GoDaddy in Japan in 2018. And to this day, every time it comes up for renewal, it renews in Japanese yen. And could I switch it to US dollars? Sure. But it's just a reminder that like this little kind of idea, light bulb moment living in Japan is where we had the idea. Then we got back to Southern California. You know, we had moved out there to launch rockets. And so we pushed Virgin Orbit all the way to launch. And then after we got the first rocket launched, we put in our resignation to go try to raise capital for Venus. So, you know, we quit our jobs in the middle of COVID. We had our kids at home from school. You know, no better time to quit your job than the middle of a global pandemic. But we did it. We took the leap and raised venture capital. And it's truly just been an adventure of a lifetime.
I love that you guys had this conversation. And I'm sure this conversation happens like every second in the world where people are like, wouldn't it be great if we could just like blink and be in another part of the world? And meanwhile, your husband is like, no, but I think we could do this. Like, yeah. That's amazing. So yeah, you mentioned quitting your job to start Venus. I guess before we move forward on that, I do want to touch on a little bit of the technology. How do you explain this technology? You touched on it a little bit with the special engine, but yeah. How do you explain the technology to people who don't have a frame of reference for how airplanes work, how space work? How do you describe what breakthrough technology you're developing?
So we are commercializing an engine. It's called the rotating detonation engine. And our marketing team jokes that we need to rebrand that because you probably hear that here, exploding exploder engine. But if you go back to like campfire 101, like what do you need for a campfire? You need fuel, you need oxygen, and you need a spark. And so our engine, so most jet engines or, you know, car engines, they actually get that oxygen from the atmosphere, right? From the air. So a rocket, the difference in a rocket and a jet, a rocket and a standard deflagration engine, is that rockets carry their own oxygen with us. And so you have a, you know, if you go back to like the space shuttle, you'd have a tank of fuel and then big tanks of oxygen. And you use that because up in the vacuum of space, you don't have oxygen. It's, you know, there's no air there. And so what Venus does is because we're using this new type of rocket engine, it allows us to fly way higher, which is ultimately way cooler. And that's what truly enables kind of a passenger space plane or a hypersonic vehicle to finally work. So we always joke Top Gun did us a great favor with Top Gun Maverick, because what happens at the very opening scene of the movie, and not to ruin it for anybody that's, you know, listening, but like opening scene, Maverick's trying to push his hypersonic jet to Mach 10. And what goes on? Heat warnings, warning, hot. And so it's the equivalent of like flying through soup when you're trying to fly that fast. But that engine that like Maverick is trying to fly is breathing it's an air breathing engine. It's getting the free oxygen from the air. And so they've got to fly low enough to get that air. But because we're a rocket engine, it's a different type of engine. We can fly way higher, carry our own oxygen, and thus fly much cooler. So it lets us go further and faster and cooler. And this engine, so it's called a detonation engine. And detonation is just the scientific phrase for supersonic combustion. So a campfire is slow, like subsonic combustion. It's a really slow burn. And this detonation engine is a supersonic combustion. And you get 15% more energy out of the same fuel. So what that really translates to, and if I'm getting too technical, you can stop me here. But what that really means is if you're way more efficient burning fuel, it means you don't have to carry as much fuel. And so suddenly you have room for wings, landing gear, safety systems, all the things that actually make a plane possible as opposed to a rocket.
Yeah, well, that makes me think that there's also like a sustainability element to, I mean, I think so much of travel, especially airfare and companies are looking for more sustainable options. This does sound like a solution to that, right?
Yeah, our ultimate goal is to go with completely carbon-free propellants. You know, there are fuel choices that we could make that would be completely carbon-free. The biggest challenge is continuous operability. You know, so if, you know, we've got to be able to land at an airport and they have the fuel that we want. And so we're working through navigating, you know, how hard do we push green, but then you've got to stand up an entirely green ecosystem across the entire globe. But I think the United, I think the world would handle that. And we're also, we recently announced publicly that we have gotten our engine to work on jet fuel and hydrogen peroxide. And so there's ways to make hydrogen peroxide as a carbon negative. And then there's ways you could use sustainable aviation fuel, which has far less carbon. And so kind of pushing, we would like to push as far green as we can. Like the space shuttle was fully green. It was hydrogen, like liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And so, you know, its output was water or steam. And so that's possible, but cryogenics, they're really, really, really cold and they're really, really hard. And they're not, if you sit on, you know, the launch pad for too long or an airport too long with cryogenics and it gets warmer and warmer, then you don't get the efficiency that you would really need to make a vehicle finally work. So there's this nice trade-off between, I don't know that I call it nice, cut that. There's a trade-off between, you know, green and high speed operations. And we're trying to figure out how do we best navigate that?
Yeah, I think it's also, you got to like almost hope. And I think some momentum is happening in that space, but you got to hope like the rest of the ecosystem is evolving toward more sustainable fuels at the same time. Like it's not on just Venus.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're solving enough challenges with a brand new type of rocket engine on a brand new type of vehicle that solving an entirely new carbon-free fuel challenge is, you know, it's the miracle that I don't know that our investors are wanting us to tackle right now.
Exactly. Okay. So going back to that origin story of Venus, you quit your jobs in 2020 to go full time with making Venus a reality. At what point did you decide to move to Houston and what went into that decision-making process?
Yeah. So we knew that when we worked for Virgin Orbit, I was practically a single mom because our headquarters were in Long Beach and all the operations happened out in Mojave, which is, you know, 3-hour drive, LA traffic, horrible. And so we knew that we had to find a location that we could test our engine and still be home for dinner. That was really our company vision is home for dinner. We want to fly you across the globe and have you home for dinner. And if you work for us, we want you home for dinner. And so we kind of started a nationwide search of where do we believe we could truly set up the company, testing rocket engines, flying drones, flying planes, and ultimately be home for dinner. And I am a seventh generation Texan. I went to Texas A&M. That's actually where I met Andrew. And so Texas was, of course, the first place we looked. And it was actually somebody at the governor's office that we were chatting with that said, "Have you looked at Houston?" And I'll be honest, I grew up in Dallas. And so my initial reaction to Houston was like, Houston, no. And they said, "Well, Houston has the Houston Spaceport at Ellington Field." And having worked at Virgin Orbit, we intimately knew what it meant to be a spaceport. And so we said, oh, we had no idea. And so the governor's office put us in touch with the folks at Ellington Airport, the spaceport. And we flew out here and said, here's what we're looking to do. You know, we literally want a place to fire rocket engines, fly drones, fly experimental aircraft, and ultimately fly commercial aircraft. And I give Arturo and Jimmy all the credit. They're like, yeah, you can do it right here. And so we got flew back home, literally, I think that was right before Thanksgiving in 2020. Flew back home, packed up our stuff, and we had our kids in school in the area in Texas, January 2021. Like, we were like, all right, let's go. This is where we want to set up our company. And that was right as we were closing our seed round of funding. And so we knew we didn't want to start somewhere and then move, like start hiring a bunch of people and then move. We wanted to get set up where we were going to be. So we worked out of our house for about 6 months as we tried to find a great location and then ultimately kind of stumbled upon this hangar at Ellington Airport. And moved in, and it's been fantastic. I mean, every morning, like I walk up and open the hangar doors and look to see what's going on in Ellington. And there's sometimes F-16s parked side, and you've got the NASA T-38s down, you know, about two hangars down from us, and all sorts of activity is going on. And across the road, you've got, you know, the Neutron Buoyancy Lab and a bunch of other new companies building up their headquarters on the Houston Spaceport. And so it's, I don't know that there's a better place to be to build a space company in 2023. It's been a good move. Yeah. I was like, what year is it?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And I mean, for a lot of people listening and also me, like it's very interesting to think about what the spaceport really looks like on a day-to-day basis. Like I've seen the photos and the renderings, but like you're there in it around like some of these really high-tech, innovative companies. And you've kind of touched on this just now, but what has it been like to be based in Houston with this in that environment? Did it kind of exceed your expectations? And if so, in what ways?
Yeah. You know, the Houston space community is, I would say, extremely collaborative and helpful. You know, there's nobody else here that's building hypersonic planes. And so, you know, people are like, how can we help you out? Who can we introduce you to? I mean, you've got NASA Johnson Space Center and we're looking at human factors and what's going to be the impact on people on our vehicle. And you've got some of the world's experts just down the road, and they're more than willing to help, more than willing to get involved. And so it's been a really good move for us. I mean, the cost of living is way cheaper. We've brought quite a bit of, you know, quite a few folks from Southern California where you're spending 65% of your income on housing. It is just so expensive to live out there. And so moving to Houston, where the cost of living is much less, the school systems are fantastic. And then you've got all of the space ecosystem going on around here where people want to help and they're excited about what we're doing. And, you know, one of the companies says, oh, we've got extra 3D printing capacity right now. What can we do to help you guys out? And just because they're part of the ecosystem with us. And then also just have all the knowledge that's here with the groups that, you know, the folks that built the space shuttle and no, you know, major propulsion systems and no guidance and navigation control and no human factors. I mean, those people are living here in our backyard and have been extremely useful. So it's been a good move for Venus. We're super glad to be here in Houston.
And everyone knows you're telling the truth because you are from Dallas and you did have your initial hesitations about Houston. No, we can trust her people. So I guess stepping forward into where you're at now, I know you've grown the company from 3 people to nearly 100. Looking back at that growth, what's been the most challenging part for you and for Venus's journey so far?
You know, it's a company of 3 people and a company of 20 people and a company of 40. Like, each of those is almost totally different companies. So building out the systems and processes for 20 people versus for 60 versus 80, it's like, there's just a lot of pieces. And so it's hard, like trying to also not get so far ahead of ourselves that like, we don't need to build a system for 500 people. Let's just build for 100 right now. And so there's this constant kind of tension between grow, build out bigger systems versus, you know, take what you have now and get it really great. You know, I think fortunately early on, we had some, you know, really great advice of how to implement culture. And because I always say, as important as the technology that we're building is, it's also just as important, like who we are, how we treat our people, you know, what the culture is, because aerospace tends to be one of extremes. I know I had folks that worked at some of the other aerospace companies that, like, one of my female founder friends, you know, worked for a different space company. She said she regularly went into the bathroom and cried. And like, that's just not acceptable. Like, that is not how we treat people. We're not gonna tolerate that. And so we want to challenge people technically, but we also want to create a culture that people are excited. They want to work here. They want to stay with us for the long haul. And so there's that kind of constant tension of go fast and get things done, but also kind of build for the long term.
Yeah, that's very interesting that your response to that question was about culture. Like, I love that, because you could have very easily been like, well, we're creating a whole different type of air travel with technology that didn't previously exist. But that's so relatable to people listening who are growing their companies and scaling, but that importance of maintaining that culture at the different phases. But yeah, let's talk about the space tech of it, because I think we have a lot of eyes on the industry right now. And I don't know necessarily what it is in particular, but I think the Artemis missions are very exciting, returning to the moon. But I wonder, from your perspective of being at the Houston Spaceport and very in the industry and seeing so much of that buzz, but also and excitement, is that translating into, you know, momentum for the businesses and for the technology?
You know, so I always find Venus is kind of in this weird edge of, we're not really a space company. We happen to be using space technology and like rocket engines, but our goal is high speed travel. So there has been a massive boom in space. And I've actually heard it kind of, it's almost like the new world. Why did the United States or America get colonized in the beginning? It was tobacco, right? There was a cash crop that you could use to go out you know, get the money and send it back. And so that's what created, you know, the colonies. And space is kind of at that moment right now where, like, kind of that space tobacco, I've heard it called, is coming. We're actually going to open up asteroid mining. One asteroid is worth like $1 trillion of platinum. You know, you can get solar panels in space. You can get in-space manufacturing. There's a bunch of things that you can't do on Earth because of gravity that space will allow you to do. And I think as launch costs are going down, so as it gets cheaper and cheaper to get things into space, then that actually opens up an entire ecosystem in terms of what's really possible. And I think we are just at the very brink of that. And so, you know, with the knowledge of what's here in Houston, what's going on, Houston has this incredible capability to really push space forward, and not just exploration, but manufacturing and solar energy and mining and all the sorts of things that are going to finally truly open up space for permanent, you know, not just exploration. And then it doesn't hurt that, there's all the buzz around Artemis, and that's excited that we're going back to the moon. And there's a lot going on in space right now. And so it's fun to watch.
Yeah. With that activity and excitement, what do you feel, and maybe we can be broad with that space industry a little bit, but what do you feel industry needs the most? Is it talent, money, technology? What do you see to continue with this momentum and excitement?
Yeah, honestly, on our end, it's patient capital, right? So I think Silicon Valley and the venture capital world got really spoiled with software. And so it's really easy to invest in a software company, to put 10 programmers in a room and to poop out a unicorn, like to, you know, grow this company to be $1 billion. But hardware and space tech, it's almost all hardware based. And so that requires, you know, they call it atoms, not bits. And so it's more capital intensive. Like, building hardware is way more expensive than building software. And so you need those investors that understand that it might take me a little longer to get my return. It's not going to just be a software, you know, throw money in and you have this incredible program and you get money out. But that it's also really good bets to make, that you can, you know, bet on industrial processes and manufacturing and hardware type companies, hard tech companies, and you can still get those returns. That's what Silicon Valley was born out of, right? It was silicon and chips and computers and hardware. So I think some venture capitalists have spun back towards that and recognized that, you know, there was this window where they called it software was eating the world, and that's where everybody wanted to invest in. And thankfully now there's folks that recognize that kind of hard tech, deep tech, that it's, those are noble causes to invest in, and they're also profitable causes. You know, so from a Venus perspective, I mean, hypersonic travel, high-speed global travel is estimated to be up to $200 billion per year. So there's this massive pot of gold at the end of this journey that opens up an incredible market. And I think space is very similar. I mean, the opportunities that exist with space in general, are just incredible, but it does take more patient capital and people willing to kind of take hardware risks as opposed to, you know, just betting on programmers.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something that has happened in the industry that I've observed, other people I've talked to have observed, of this long overdue hard tech revolution. Like, we've done as much as we can with the software development. It's time for hardware to kind of step to the forefront. When you think of that future and all of the things that have to come into play and fall as dominoes, I guess, for the company to be successful, what keeps you up at night? What are you keeping a close eye on to see how it'll affect Venus?
The thing that keeps me up the night the most is almost always fundraising. You know, Andrew and I are not two billionaires with a bunch of money in our pockets to fund this. Like, we were two engineers with a crazy idea and a dream and kind of decided to go for it. And so we have to have capital. You know, our earliest markets are the Department of Defense. I mean, hypersonics is one of the top priorities for the U.S. But the government moves slow. And so trying to, you know, build all the correct relationships to get government funding, and kind of, we call it skating to the puck. Like, you know, we know that the U.S. needs hypersonic capabilities. And so by getting there and building them as quickly as possible, we're trusting that some of the government non-dilutive capital will come in. But at the same time, we have to get, you know, the right investment partners. The other piece that, you know, we're really watching is obviously regulatory. So right now there's no rules on how do you fly hypersonic. And so the FAA is reauthorization is up this year in Congress. And so we're working to get language put into the most recent FAA legislation to kind of start looking at, hey, hypersonic travel, high-speed travel is coming. You know, hey, FAA, how are you going to deal with it? And trying to help kind of dictate the legislation there to help to make sure that we have a future where, you know, when we get to a hypersonic vehicle that's ready to fly and move passengers, and we've proven that it's completely safe and we can do it, we don't want the FAA to come in and say, nope, just kidding, you're not allowed to do this. And so kind of for us, it's the capital and the regulatory. I'm not as worried about the technology. I actually think we've got the solution, and now it's kind of an engineering challenge, not a science challenge. But you know, those are still some pretty big hurdles that we get to go try to push through.
Yeah, pretty big dominoes.
Pretty big dominoes, yeah.
So one thing that has been really exciting this year is that you were named one of Inc. magazine's female founders on the list of 200 in, I think, the world. So what does that honor mean to you personally? And maybe you can put it in the Venus scope as well.
You know, it's as a mom of two daughters, I love that I can show them that this is possible, that, you know, I'm in a group of female founders, female aerospace founders, that we've all raised seed or series A rounds of money. And I think there's eight of us. And that's every single aerospace female founder that we know in the entire United States, like eight out of probably thousands of companies. And so just trying to be that example for other women that you can go do this. Like, I can't tell you the number of conferences I've been at for space or aerospace, where I tend to be one of the only females in the room. I tend to want to be one of the only females on stage. And so if I can inspire some other woman, some other female to go try, and so show them that it's possible. It's just, you know, I'm kind of standing on the shoulder of some giants that come before me. And I hope that I can help provide that inspiration for some other lady that's listening to this podcast right now. That's like, you know, hey, if you've got an idea, like go for it. Go, like, there's venture capital out there. There's partners out there. You don't have to know everything. I think if I gave anybody advice, it's like, you don't have to know it all. You can bring in partners that can help you with that expertise. And so don't be afraid to go try.
I think that's such a great piece of advice, just because I think women in general tend to put a little bit too much on their plate, tend to think that this is my company, I have to do it all. But that's a great reminder to kind of be like, no, you don't.
Yeah. No, there's early stage incubators, there's accelerators, there's people that are experts in certain areas that can totally help with things. And so, you know, it's just, I always say it's one bite at a time, right? Like, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? How do you build a space plane company? You know, one tiny step at a time. And, you know, I can look back on the last 3 years and the things that I've learned are incredible. And I'm sure as I look forward, it's only going to continue. And so learn every day, have that grit. Like, if you are trying to raise venture capital, my advice is it only takes one yes. Even when we went out to raise our seed round, I think we pitched 180 people, but it only took one to say yes. And so you got to have grit, just keep pushing. But if you know you've got a great idea, there's somebody out there that'll believe in you and fund it. And so I'd say, don't be afraid to try.
180 pitches, everyone. That is, that's a lot. And look where you're at now. So that's a good message and reminder to people who are like, maybe they're facing their 40th and they're like, oh, okay, I can do this. I can do, you know, if Sassy can do 180. All right. Well, this was really great to talk to you and to hear the Venus Aerospace story, the Sassy story. It's so exciting to see the company. And I know I said at the top of the show that I've heard you pitch and present and talk in different capacities, and it's always inspiring. So thank you for doing that and for coming on the show today.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Houston Innovators Podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss next week's edition, and check out innovationmap.com for the latest Houston startup and innovation news.